Okay, good evening. Tonight's topics, are a little bit complex. It's really an overlap of really three different topics which have overlapping sources. So we're going to try to talk about all three of them at the same time and try to get together the sources that talk about the interlapping things all together at once, because essentially we have been talking these past few weeks about laws of Lashon Hara in general, and more specifically these more recent few weeks about the laws of when Lashon Hara is permissible or required, when we have circumstances which are known as toelas, when something is purposeful, when we are obligated or permitted or obligated, depending on the circumstances, to say something which would normally be prohibited. So one of the main arenas in which that plays out is the arena of shiduchim, that if you know somebody who's about to enter into a shidduch or into a business deal, or any other type of close relationship with somebody, and that relationship could be damaging, so this is one of the primary examples of when this issue comes up. So that's one of the topics. One of the topics is the subset of toelas that refers to shiduchim, but it ties in with two other topics, because one of the questions, one of the issues that you have to figure out in terms of what you are obligated to reveal about somebody else, ties in very much to the question of what is the individual themselves required to reveal. If somebody is dating, if somebody is considering entering into a marriage relationship, so to what extent are they obligated to say everything about themselves? It's a very complex question. And that influences the first question, because if we assume there's something that you have to reveal, so then if a third party has good reason to believe that the first party is not revealing that, that's when the question comes up, is the third party obligated to be the one to reveal that information? And the third interlocking topic is, since many of these issues, certainly not all, but many of them may be medically related, and therefore they could come up in the context of a medical relationship, a doctor could find out some piece of information in this category, and then be confronted with the question of whether or not he's obligated to reveal the information. So it ties into the issue of medical confidentiality. So essentially, we're going to try to talk about those three topics at once, because the sources overlap. Essentially, these are three issues. The issue of what a person who is considering a marriage is obligated to reveal about themselves, and therefore, by extension, what a third party would be obligated to reveal if the party themselves either don't know or is not revealing. And the issues of medical confidentiality, which are intertwined with that topic. So to begin with, to consider it from the medical confidentiality perspective, so there are two broad sets of issues that are relevant to medical confidentiality. Each one of them has subsets, but there are two broad sets of issues, so we'll talk about them separately. The first one is the arena of Lashon Hara and related issues, which again is our starting point for this whole discussion. So in general, we know there is a prohibition to needlessly reveal negative information, to say something derogatory about somebody else, if there's no purpose, if it doesn't serve saving anybody from harm or anything like that. So normally there is a prohibition. So it's important to understand this does not only apply to derogatory information, not only somebody's misbehavior or something like that, but also anything that somebody considers to be private, anything that one knows in confidence, there is in general a prohibition to reveal it. There's a separate prohibition, it's called Gilui Sod, revealing secrets. It's very separate, but it's really considered to be a subset of Lashon Hara in general. The word Rechilus, the word we identify with Lashon Hara, it's found in the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Losevech Rachel B'Yamecha, one should not be a Rachel, one should not be a talebearer, Rachel literally is a peddler, one should not be somebody who goes around peddling his wares, in this case, gossip. So the Pasuk in Mishlei also uses the word Rachel in the context of Holech Rachel Megalus Od, that somebody who walks around as a peddler, one of the things he does is he reveals secrets. So this connection is quoted by many as pointing to the fact that if somebody reveals a secret, even if it's not inherently derogatory, even if it's not something you would necessarily say right away, that's a bad thing about the person, but if it's confidential in nature, that's also considered to be a prohibition of Lashon Hara that would be governed by the rules of Lashon Hara. That's if something is told to you in confidence, something in private, something that you have a reason to believe is confidential in nature. Now, there is a more expansive statement that Gemara has in the beginning of Masechet Yuma, that there is a presumption of confidentiality. The Gemara has a statement that if somebody says something to you, there is an assumption of bal komer, an assumption that you should not repeat it until the person gives you specific permission to repeat it. The Gemara understands that from a pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. There's a whole discussion over there. So many of the commentaries understood that that's not the absolute basic law. That's more midas derech eretz. That the real prohibition of gilui sod, that's when somebody tells you something that's clearly confidential in nature, either because they state it's confidential or because the context makes it obvious that it's confidential. That's when you really have a prohibition. The idea that the Gemara says it is a default of confidence, that it's automatically assumed that you shouldn't repeat it. So that's a derech eretzic idea. That's a nice value to try to adhere to. But if that comes into conflict with other issues, so that falls away more quickly because the Tal Stern has a truth about this and his truth is with Tala Chachma. It's generally assumed that that's probably not a absolute prohibition as much as a Derech Eretz type of advice. So that's true in terms of something that somebody tells you that they express some type of confidentiality about, so the prohibition to reveal. But also the prohibition of Lashon Hara is also understood to extend to anything that would cause the subject discomfort. So if somebody wants something kept private, so to bring it out into public, so that's also considered to be a prohibition of Lashon Hara. The Rambam in his formulation in the Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Deis, where he codifies all the rules of Lashon Hara, so the Rambam has two definitions of Lashon Hara. He comes at it twice. First, in the second halacha, the seventh parak of Hilchos Deis, first he says, what is Lashon Hara? He says, anybody who speaks disparagingly about somebody else, that's Lashon Hara. Then, a few halachas later, in halacha hey, he comes back and he starts over again, and he says, so what is Lashon Hara? So Lashon Hara is if you're going to reveal something, which, by it being revealed, is going to cause some type of problem for the person you're talking about. Either because it's going to cause them physical harm, material harm, or discomfort, or fear, or annoyance, anything like that, that's going to be included in the prohibition of Lashon Hara. So that also addresses the fact that something that is confidential in nature, something that a person would want to have it kept private, even if it's not inherently derogatory, is, at least in theory, going to be included within the rubric of Lashon Hara. And it's also important to note that this is true not only about the one speaking, but if somebody would try to find out for himself such information, even without somebody speaking, if somebody would use whatever access they have to try to find that information that's personal about somebody else, that's not relevant to them, that doesn't have any immediate purpose, just because of their curiosity, so it's assumed that that's probably also a problem. You know, the Chulas Halachas Kitanis is an older sefer, so he suggests that that's also a prohibition of Rechilas. It's an interesting formulation. There's a language of the Torah that calls Lashon Hara peddling, tail-bearing, walking around with stories. So he has an expression over there. It says, Mali Rocha L'Acherin, Mali Rocha L'Atma. What's the difference? A person takes the stories and gives it to somebody else, or he takes it and gives it to himself. So if you're going to take somebody's information and pass it on to a third party, or you're going to try to obtain it for yourself and tell it to yourself, he thought that was the same model of Rechil, which is also a contemporary sefer in the laws of neighbors, Hilchos Nizkei Shkenim, where he has a similar formulation. He says that just as information that a person would want private, so you shouldn't reveal to somebody else, he says, so essentially, to reveal it to yourself, there's no difference. It's just there's a different model of Lashon Hara. Normally, Lashon Hara is three people involved. One person, Reuven, speaks to Shimon about Levi. So in this case, Reuven speaks to himself about Levi. So he plays two of the three parts. But it's the same basic prohibition of Lashon Hara. Anything that's confidential, to find out for yourself, if it's not something that's potentially relevant to your protection, so then that's going to have the same type of heading. So in theory, so you have a prohibition of Lashon Hara that's certainly going to apply to all of these issues. But that being the case, Lashon Hara, as we mentioned, is governed by a rule known as Toelos, that if something is purposeful, so then we find that it's either permissible or very often obligatory for a person to reveal what he knows to somebody who is potentially at risk. And as we discussed a little bit in the past weeks, that there are two basic models to understand why that is. There are two different conceptual models to understand how something flips from being prohibited to being obligatory, and it's important to keep the two models in mind because they give different types of results. So one model is that we could assume that if we look at Lashon Hara as a character issue, if we look at it as an issue that a person enjoys gossiping, a person is engaging, indulging in a negative character trait, so one could argue that if something is purposeful, if something is toelos, so then it's simply not in this definition. It's not called Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, by its very nature, is purposeless is gossip, and if it's purposeful, so it's simply not included in this prohibition. That's how some understand that the footman has a letter in which he thought this was for sure the understanding. Some note that there's another pasuk besides the pasuk in Kedoshim, the pasuk in Mishpatim, that the Gemara also connects to the prohibition of Lashon Hara. The pasuk says really referring to accepting, to receiving Lashon Hara, and the Gemara interprets it as referring to speaking also. The Gemara says, the pasuk says, Lo sisa shema shav, one should not accept a report that is shav. So what does that word shav mean? So it could mean different things, but some understand it to mean that it's purposelessness. It doesn't have any reason for it. So if you're going to accept a report that has no reason, you're going to listen to some derogatory thing about somebody else for no reason, that's a violation of this prohibition. So the footnote and others understand that if there's a purpose, if there's a reason for saying it, so then it's not going to be subject to that type of category. While others understand differently, others understand that the prohibition of Lashon Hara is not necessarily governed by being a character trait. It's not about a characteristic, but it's about the practicality. It's about the damage that you cause to somebody else. Now, if you're hurting somebody through speech, if you're putting somebody at risk because you're saying something about them that could hurt them, so then that's a prohibition of Lashon Hara, regardless of what qualities are involved and what character traits are there. Even if you have innocent motives, even if you don't have any nastiness involved, but if you're going to say something that's going to cause somebody problems, so then that's a prohibition of Lashon Hara. So if that's the case, if we use that model, so then the cases of Tawelish, where you're talking about somebody who's going to lose out on a shidduch, who's going to lose out on a business deal, so would that be defined as Lashon Hara? Absolutely. That's the main way in which you can hurt somebody. The only thing is, even though it's Lashon Hara, it's required to do it anyway, because it's outweighed by something else. There's another imperative, and that imperative is, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa. We're not allowed to stand by when somebody is at risk. And one could have read the pasuk to say if somebody is at mortal risk, if somebody is potentially going to die, so you can't stand by and let that happen. If you look in the Rambam, though the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam has a much more expansive reading of this. He understands it to mean not just absolute mortal risk, but any type of physical risk, and not just physical risk, but any type of material risk as well. That dam re'echa, so the word dam in biblical language and in Talmudical language, means on the one hand, physical well-being, damim. On the other hand, it means money also. Damim also refers to material properties. So Rambam understands it extensively, that lo samar al dam re'echa means you can't stand by when somebody is at risk, either physically or materially or any other way, if somebody's going to get hurt, so you can't stand by and let that happen. So if that's the case, so essentially we have a values clash. That we have, on the one hand, we don't want to hurt people through speech, but on the other hand, we have a primary commitment to an innocent victim, that somebody would be hurt by this person, so that comes first. And that outweighs the prohibition of Lashon Hara. And in that context, it's striking to note that they're both included in the same pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. The pasuk there says, Lo seileh rachel b'yamecha, lo samur al dam re'echa, that one should not walk around telling stories. But on the other hand, one is not allowed to stand by if somebody could get hurt. So one could read the pasuk as saying, these are two halves of the equation. You can't talk badly about people unless they could hurt somebody else. Then you have to act and you have to let the second value outweigh the first. So those two models are different, and it's important to keep in mind the differences, because on the one hand, the first model essentially gives us a wider berth. It says that if we're motivated by anything other than gossip, anything other than nastiness, if you have some type of purpose in mind, so essentially it's not covered by these prohibitions. While the second model is more of a challenge, the second model requires more of an analysis to be done, that it sees here essentially a values clash between, on the one hand, not hurting the person who we're talking about, on the other hand, making sure an innocent party is not hurt by that person, and therefore that requires more of a consideration, more of a cost-benefit analysis. So what justifies saying what? And that's where things get complicated, and that's why things are complicated, that we're trying to calculate exactly how these values land up, how they're going to match up against each other, what type of risk are we talking about, what type of likelihood are we talking about, when is it relevant, and that's why these questions are as complicated as they are, and that's why they are essentially all going to be judgment calls, and that's I think part of why there is so much attention, why there's appropriately so much attention to the laws of Lashon Hara, because when you have to have a refined sensitivity and an educated discretion is to try to figure out how we weigh up these two things against each other. It's not the kind of thing that there's an easy computer formula to figure out. It takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of judgment and a lot of understanding, and that's part of why these questions are so complex. So part of what we're going to try to do tonight is we'll talk a little bit about some of the principles that are involved, but even after the principles, so there's still not going to be an absolute formula. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the case history, about some of the tshuva literature, which has been printed, what different posts have said in different circumstances, which again is not going to be a final formula, but it's going to be a little bit of indicative of some of the back and forth analysis and judgment that goes into the issue. One of the arenas in which you see that it's complicated, there is an area that if we know that a person poses a risk to somebody else, you know that somebody is considering marrying somebody, and you know this person is a definite risk to them, either because they hurt people, or in the cases more close to what we're talking about today, not because they necessarily want to hurt anybody, but because they have a medical condition which is going to impinge significantly on their lives. And it's interesting that most of the literature, you'd think the first example that might pop into your head when we talk about medical issues and damage is issues of contagious diseases, of things that can be spread to other people. So that certainly fits into this discussion, but it's not something the literature focuses on that much. You don't find so much of discussion about that in this area. You find it more in the area of the Bikur Cholim. There's a whole discussion in Poskim about whether or not you're obligated to visit people who are sick when they are contagious. And there's more of a discussion of the tshuva, for example, tshuva's Chemdas Tzvi, where he has a whole discussion where he talks about how people who are contagious and who might have people visiting them have an obligation to make sure the whole world knows just how contagious they are so that people who would consider visiting would know what exactly the story is. So in that context, you find it more. You find it a little bit less in this discussion, but it's more in the cases of where a person has a medical condition that would impinge on the marital life, impinge on the happiness and the viability of the marriage overall. There you find this discussion coming up more. So if you know there's a kind of thing which it's a definite issue for people, a definite problem, a person poses a definite risk to somebody else, or it's a kind of a health issue that is so objective and obvious, so then there is a clear obligation, first of all, on the person themselves to reveal it, but if the person, if you know for a fact that that's not happening, so then there would be a clear obligation on somebody else to reveal it. But it's also reflective of how complicated this is, that we also have this in-between category where there are certain things that if somebody asks you about, so you're obligated to answer. Normally a person asks you about lashon hara, a person says, you know, what gossip do you know? So the fact that they ask doesn't make it any more permissible. You know, you're not supposed to talk about it even if somebody wants to know. But in this situation, if somebody says, I'm considering marrying somebody, or my daughter's considering marrying somebody, and I want to know, do they have this and this issue? Is this such and such true about them? Even if it's not something which is objectively, in your mind, that kind of a problem, if they ask, so usually that is going to pose an obligation for you to answer the question straightforwardly. So one could ask the question, you know, why should it make a difference if they ask or if they don't ask? Either it's the kind of thing which you don't want to talk about even if they ask, as I said before, stam lashon hara, somebody asks, you're not supposed to answer. And if it's something that's so important, if it's something that's a matter of protecting them, so then maybe you shouldn't have to wait till they ask. Maybe you should, or you should be allowed to wait till they ask. Maybe you should be obligated to share the information to everyone, make sure everyone knows preemptively. So, we'll take a second. So that's part of a question that you see there's this kind of in-between area where there is a judgment that becomes more complex. And some of the svarim explain that there are things which are not objective problems, but if the person asks you, so then they're showing you that they think this is something significant. So the fact that they had it, they didn't ask you, so then it's a suffix, then it's the kind of thing which you're not sure is a problem. But by bringing it up, you're definitely going to taint things. You're definitely going to cause a inclination against the person who might have no problems. Otherwise, it's not going to be so fair to the person you're talking about. But if the other person says, I need to know this, this is something that's important to me, so then that changes it. There is a possibility, Rav Yosef is quoted somewhere as saying that if you really think something is a complete non-relevance, it doesn't impact at all, and you know they're never going to find out the other way, you know it's not going to hurt their lives, even if they ask you, you're not obligated to tell. That's a little bit more dangerous territory because that's not really something you can so easily evaluate. Probably not advisable to take that path. But the kind of things that people ask about that are not so obviously objective, that's this in-between category, that there are things that people ask about which gives it its own status, and that puts it into a different category.
I think you were first up.
Because I'm not 100% sure, I'm starting, I'll bring up the issue I was discussing a few years ago, and it's such a civil gathering queen, a different way of feeling about it. Someone who is 100% under control already a few years and is under a certain medication, but medically the physician will say he is 100% under control. Why is the general office about that?
Yeah, so that's that will hopefully come out a little bit from some of the case literature that we'll talk about. It's hard to answer any of these questions on one foot, but there is a general view that if a person can live such a life that the spouse never has to encounter the issue at all, or never maybe has to encounter seeing the person take pills, but never has to encounter any type of suffering from it, and then presumably also you have to know that the person is trustworthy to keep themselves under control forever, and in theory it doesn't have to impact their lives, so then one could make a strong case that that's not the kind of thing to, there is some literature that's similar to that, but again there's a lot of judgments involved in there as well, so all kinds of gray areas that one could tweak the story where it's going to become more tilted to one side or the other, but one of the principles that is mentioned is that if potential is there, that in theory the other person could live 100 years and never even know about it, maybe let's say the person takes a pill every morning secretly and the spouse would never know, then there is room to say that that might not be something. Yeah, there is literature that I can show you. I will discuss some of it. But again, there is some subjectivity there as well. You know, and the question is, what if the person can't be trusted to stay on the post forever? There are issues that could still come up. It's a broad principle that's relevant to that. Hi. Right.
Do you think it's a good match? I mean, they're not asking for anything factual per se, anything that affects anything per se, but their own opinion.
So that's very similar to what we were just saying about here, the issue when they ask you. So on the one hand, it's very important for people to have modesty about what they know and about what their exposure is to things and how much their opinion covers. And I think also when people are asking, it's important people to know the limits of the awareness of the people who they're talking to, that whether or not anybody's qualified to say what's a good match or not, the access people have to this is very limited. So it's important for the question to know that, it's important for the answer to be aware of that and to convey things as such. That being the case, when a person asks you something, so here in the context of what we're talking about now, about why should it make a difference whether they ask you or not, if it should either be one way or the other, either you should have to say it without asking, or you shouldn't be able to say it at all. So there is a certain status. A person asks you, they're saying, okay, your opinion is now important to me, your opinion has a status as a fact, so before they ask me, so my opinion wouldn't necessarily have any consequence. But once they ask me, okay, so now my opinion in theory takes on a different status that now has a kind of a quasi-factual nature to it, becomes a little bit more of something substantial. But again, that being said, and we've had many experiences of this, it is important for the questioner and the answerer to both be aware of the limits of the ability and just look around the world and see how many happy marriages there are where nobody would have guessed and nobody would have said it was a good match. So it's important to have a lot of humility in terms of that, in terms of anybody's ability to guess what's a good match and what's not. Those kind of questions should be taken with a significant amount of salt. I think that it's first. Right, so part of the subjectivity here, and part of the issue, and we'll try to talk about it a little bit more, is that once we already see the issue itself is subject to a lot of judgment, so even things that are supposed to be revealed, we'll talk about this more in a second, when and how they're supposed to be revealed makes a huge difference. And sometimes if it's the kind of thing that's objective and glaring, it might be one thing, and if it's something which is more subjective or more able to be taken within a certain context, then the situation is going to change, and we'll try to talk about that in a minute. Hi. Right.
Than others, some can be, even 30 minutes.
30 minutes total.
So, they talk about the second date and the third date, and where they you're going to tell, when do you tell?
Right, that's part of the question that was just asked, and we'll try to get to in a second. That certainly, as you also alluded to, is very circumstantial and very given to being changed in different communities. A community that has where it's common to have a several month courtship, and a community where it's common to have two or three day stops, is going to have a radically different scale of when that is. But let's try to get into that a little bit. So essentially, also just to give some more context to it. So part of the issues are the interrelated questions of what the dater is obligated to reveal and what a third party is obligated to reveal. So just to give some categories, so one of the things, you know, again, if you know a person is damaging to somebody else, and a person has potential to harm somebody else, that's certainly something which is overwhelming. But then there are other issues which are going to be more subjective. So even within these subjective factors, which are not necessarily about physical harm, but about other things, so then there is a range of issues that we're concerned about. So one of the issues that we're concerned about is a very practical issue, really transcends all these issues, is you could disqualify the kedushin, that if a person marries somebody else and there is something which is objective, which if the average person knew about this, they would not want to get involved, and we could say that with some type of confidence, that there's something which most people would consider to be something that is significantly problematic. So then that calls into question, it's a very complex issue, and it's controversial in other areas because of how it's applied. But strictly speaking, at least on paper, there is such a thing as a mekach tos when it comes to kedushin, and there is such a thing as a marriage under false pretenses, that if there is some objective glaring issue that was present at the time of the wedding, and it was concealed from one of the parties, and it's the kind of thing that they can honestly say, had they known about it at the time, they never would have gotten married. So that could disqualify the whole kedushin. So that's one of the, that's the strongest category of the kind of information that has to be revealed beforehand. But in addition to that, so then there are other things which are not so objective, which would not necessarily be able to say that had the average person known, they never would have gotten involved, but there are things which significantly skew the understanding that a person, maybe a person subjectively wouldn't have gotten involved, or a person would have gotten involved, but they would have done it much less readily. So then that's an issue that's called ona. An issue in terms of business, it's called price fraud. A person, let's say, pays more than they would have normally paid for an item. So there is an overlap here between the area of business and the area of kedushin. Both of them are binding relationships. So the question of the transaction, the same type of thing that would disqualify a transaction. So if a person buys a car and it turns out that the car doesn't have an engine, or something that is so fundamental to the car working, you could say it's clear that nobody would have bought a car under those circumstances. So then that kind of thing would disqualify the sale. That's for the person to come back and say, I want my money back, the sale is nothing. But then there's an in-between kind of situation where the car works and the car is valuable, but they paid more than they would have paid because they didn't know about some other type of glaring issue. So then that gets into an issue that's called ona, which has different parameters, but that's also a prohibition for a person to do that to somebody else. So that's also an area where a person is obligated to reveal. But then there's another area where things get much more complicated. This has to do with Geneva staff. I think we're not going to get everything into it. Sir? Okay, well, what time should we go to? Okay, so we'll see how later we go. So there's an issue called Geneva staff. So Geneva staff is a more subtle issue, and it poses a big challenge to the whole structure of dating, as we'll see in a second, except for the fact that there's an important principle of the stipler. That Gnevus Das essentially means that you have a situation, if we use a business example, so Gnevus Das, you can have a circumstance where somebody buys something, and they would have bought it even had they known about a problem that was concealed, and they would have paid the same amount. They would have bought it, and they would have paid the same amount. But they thought they were getting a better deal. So they paid $10,000 for a car, and even had they known about a certain flaw, they still would have paid the $10,000. But they thought they were getting a better deal, and that was concealed from them. So that's the problem of Geneva Das. So if we carry that over to the marriage model, so then we're in big trouble, because that disqualifies every single setup that ever was. Right? Because everybody has some issue that wasn't clear at the beginning. So if we're going to say that even an issue which the person would not regret the marriage and would have entered into the marriage with just as much enthusiasm, but even that has to be revealed, so then what's left? So then you have to talk about everything.
So here there's an important principle of the Stipler Gaon. The Stipler Gaon in his commentary from the Sefer Yevamos has a principle which not everybody agreed with, but it's very useful for this, where he essentially says as follows. This is not a shocking statement. There's a difference between merchandise and people. Okay, that's introduction number one. So what's the difference? The difference is, let's take the model of buying a car. So if I bought a car, so maybe, yes, I would have bought the car anyway. And I would have paid the same amount of money even had I known about this flaw. But let's say, a year later, the seller comes to me and says, I know you don't regret buying the car, and I know you don't think you paid too much. But what I'll do for you, because I feel bad, I'll trade the model you have for a perfect model. I have a perfect car which doesn't have that flaw. I will give you this car instead, and you can take that one. So would a person take such a deal? Presumably yes. Why not? Take a perfect car. So that model does not transfer over to human relationships. So you take a couple that's been happily married for 15 years, and they don't regret it, and they're just as enthusiastic as when they started, so you can't come up to such a person and say, the flaw that your spouse has that you didn't know about when you got married, so I can trade you now. I'll give you another husband or wife who doesn't have that flaw, and will you take that trade? So such a concept doesn't exist. There's no such thing. Right? People are so variable. People are so different that there's no such concept. That breaks down the comparison. Yeah, there is no such thing. So that doesn't hold over. So those kind of things you don't have an obligation to reveal. And in that context, the postum are quite emphatic that there is a contextual issue. That's why they also emphasize that those types of things, even if one decides they should be revealed, or again, maybe some such things you don't have to reveal at all, but some types of things that do go past the threshold, they should be revealed, specifically only within a certain framework, only after there's some type of context, because the post can have a language across the board that b'tchila kol davar katan mekalkil, that in the beginning, every small thing causes a problem, because when a person hasn't met the person yet, so they say, oh, that person has a flaw. Why would I want to get involved with somebody who's not perfect? I could be dating all these perfect people who I heard about. Why would I want to get involved with the imperfect person? So it's only once they meet the people and then they realize everybody's imperfect. So then once they have a little bit of a relationship and they're a little bit more exposed to the positives, so then they can take it in context. So there are some things which have to be revealed, but should only be revealed later. And in terms of the whole Mekach Tos thing, so then really the point where Mekach Tos becomes an issue is before the actual Kiddushin itself. So then there are certain things which don't necessarily have to be revealed in the dating stage, but before there is an actual marriage would have to be revealed, because the marriage can't take place without this information being disclosed. But in theory, could be related later on once the person has the opportunity to see the positive elements and to put it in some context. So how much later on? So yes, it's true that it's the actual marriage that creates the real problem. A person gets actually married without knowing this information, that could be a real issue. But what about various stages along the way? So engagement is certainly a very significant milestone, and certainly there's a big difference between breaking off something right before engagement and right after engagement in terms of embarrassment, in terms of the harm done to both parties. So that's certainly also a significant issue. It's less absolute than after marriage, but it is a very significant point as well. So one could make a case that most things that have to be revealed before marriage probably have to be revealed before engagement as well, even though, again, there is a difference, but it still incurs significant issues. And then once we're talking about before engagement, so what's the difference between before the first date and before engagement? And, of course, each community is going to have a different length of time as to when that is. So the difference is, so then a person is wasting time and money and emotion in terms of getting to them, and also the opportunity to meet other people. So those are all significant. They're not as significant as marrying the wrong person, but they're all something that is something to be weighed in the equation. So that's also part of the whole question, a part of the equation, how we figure out, okay, what price is this person paying by spending some period of time, emotion, and money, and the opportunity cost in a relationship that may have an issue, and that's part of where all this judgment comes in. You'll have different advice and different ways of advising when this point should be brought up and how it should be brought up, etc. There is also, in this context, similar to the Stipler's point, there's an interesting expression that the Klausenberger Rebbe has in his Tshuvas, the Divrei Yatzis, the Halberstam, the Kusil Halberstam, and his Tshuvas has a strange kind of expression where he says that nowadays, some of these lower level issues, it says the minig, the custom is to turn a blind eye towards them. The custom is to not pay attention to them. And there's a contemporary posek, there's also a Klausenberger chassid, the name of the Yitzchak Shmuel Shechter, also Chuvus Yashiv Yitzchak. So he explains that the Gemara has a phrase sometimes, minig mevatel halacha, that sometimes a minig can override even the basic halacha. So is what the Klausenberger Rebbe says, a minig not to pay attention to some things, that can override sometimes the disclosure of some of these minor issues. So what does he mean by that? Well, presumably he means that it's like a takanas hashuk kind of thing, that it's a institution in order for society to work, that if people are going to be disclosing everything on the first date. So again, called over Carton McAlkill, nobody's ever going to meet anybody else, and nobody's ever going to get married. So even though, strictly speaking, if we use a business model, there might be a broader obligation of disclosure. So when it comes to dating and marriage, the standards might be a little bit different, because otherwise nobody will ever get married, and you're not going to have a society. So in this case, the minig mevatel halacha, the custom to not focus so much on some of these smaller things is going to override the disclosure rules that might be true in business, but might be a little bit different when applied to human relationships in this case. Okay, so those are in terms of some of the broader principles as far as Lashon Hara is concerned. As far as the basic ethical issues, as far as, let's say, this is a whole second set of issues, separate from the Lashon Hara concern, is what about the professional obligation that a doctor has to a patient? And that has a micro model and a macro model. So a micro model is, let's say the situation is that a patient revealed something to the doctor and made the doctor swear not to reveal it to anyone else. I'm telling you this in confidence, and I'm assuming, I'm asking you to promise you're not going to tell anybody. So that's a issue that Post can discuss, the question of if we assume, based on the first set of principles that we said, that there is some overriding risk to somebody else, so would such an oath be binding? Would such a promise have force to it? So on the one hand, there is a strong basis to saying not, because we have a rule that promises like this are not binding. A shvuah is not binding. It's technically called a shvuah, a commitment to do something or to not do something. We technically call a shvuah. It's a little bit last week's parsha. That shvuah that we read about in the beginning of Parshas Matos, Le'afel Devaro. So that obligation not to profane your speech, not to say something and not stick to it, that is not binding when it's going to override a Torah obligation, or even when it's going to affirm a Torah obligation. It just doesn't have any power on top of the Torah. So if there is an obligation to save somebody else, if we say that you know something and that you could save somebody's life by saying it, and that's the mitzvah to say, so then most of the posts can assume, at least as a working premise, that probably an oath, a shvuah, is not going to be binding in such a case. But that will just take the present. Oh, right. Correct. So then the law is... I want to discuss it in two phases. So the broad issue now of the professional obligation of the doctor to the patient. So before getting to the premises of the profession, let's discuss with a more specific model, where let's assume, without getting into the law or the basic ethics of the profession, that the patient said, I'm asking you to promise me not to tell. So then how binding is that? So there is a strong case to say that it's not binding. In fact, the Ramah sounds like he's talking about this explicitly, where he says if somebody knows testimony that could help somebody else, and he promised the subject of the testimony that he wouldn't reveal it to anyone, the Ramah says explicitly that that promise is not binding. He has an obligation to come forward with what he knows that is helpful, and such a promise is not going to be binding. So on the surface, it sounds like that's going to apply here. Technically speaking, Post can discuss it. Yitzchak Zilberstein is a prominent Post can answer, so has a long letter about this. Other Post can talk about this as well. There could be technical reasons why that may not be applicable, why maybe the oath might be binding. First of all, because it's not a straight oath to violate the Torah, that when the person took the oath, he didn't necessarily think he was going to be put in any position against the Torah. It's kind of a broader commitment, which then later on had a detail which came into conflict with something else, so it could be that it is technically binding. Also, the Ramah statement about Eidos might be specific to formal Eidos in the Beis Din. If we have a setting where it's not a formal Beis Din type of context, and a person has a very different level of credibility and a different level of obligation, so then there is what to be said that maybe technically speaking that might not apply, and maybe technically speaking the oath might be binding. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't tell. It means that you're in a quandary, because that's how the Vishka Gluberstein, for example, discusses this. So he assumes in this case that the juror would have to tell if it's a real issue to somebody else. But at the same time, the oath could be binding. So what do you do? So one approach is to be mater neder, to go to Beis Din and to say that you have a situation here where you need the neder to be undone, as we do before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that we have such a process of Hetan Adarim, which we didn't read about in Rashi's Parsha, because the Mishnah says that it's kind of between the lines in the Torah, so it's not explicitly spelled out, but there is such a concept of Hetan Adarim. So one could have thought that maybe it's unnecessary, and that's how some posts can direct, that such a setting is so obviously compulsory that you don't even have to go through a Hetan Adarim, but others thought that at least to be safe, if possible, one should have his neder formally abrogated to be able to then move forward with this and to explain to the Beis Din or the Chacham, wherever you go to, that this is a situation you found yourself in conflict and you need to have the neder officially undone. Although even that, in other circumstances, would be tricky because we have a concept of Hetter Nedarim, so normally that doesn't apply to what's called a Noder Al Das Acherim. The person doesn't just make a commitment to himself, but he makes a commitment to another person. He says, I promise you that I'm going to do something. So then normally that's an exclusion from the rules of Hetan Adarim. Normally you can't go to a Beis Din and have that undone. So we still need to assume that there's some type of exception to even assume that Hetan Adarim is going to work. There's a whole discussion under what categories, under what circumstances that would be a concern. But that's the advice that many posts can have. The person should go through a formal Hetan Adarim in order to then perform their responsibility of saying what needs to be said if a person really poses a significant risk to somebody else and it reaches that type of a threshold, which as we saw is a little bit subjective as to what's involved there. There are other issues to be concerned about. Yitzchak Zilberstein, again, in that shuvah, he also questions whether maybe there's an issue of theft involved, there's an issue of gezel, that the person pays money to the doctor and says, I'm hiring you under the assumption of certain conditions, and one of the conditions is that he's not going to reveal the information, so then it's what to figure out from that angle as well. If the person does reveal the information to somebody else, is that a violation of theft? In the end, he thinks it's okay, but it's also part of the balance here, and it's part of the difficult weighing of issues, that maybe that's something to be concerned about also, that when you violate an agreement with somebody who paid you money for that agreement, then maybe there's an issue of theft involved as well, and that's also a part of the consideration. So that's in terms of a personal commitment that the doctor makes to the patient. But what about the broader issue that there's a medical ethics premise, that there's a premise of professional ethics, that the doctor is under the presumption, regardless of what he may have said or not have said to this individual patient, that there's a premise across the board that the doctor is going to keep everything confidential. So how does that apply here? So that's a tricky question, but it's probably comparable. The Tzitz Eliezer, who's very active in medical issues, so he has many tshuvas where he takes it as a duffer pashut, that no doctor, when he makes such a commitment, would have in mind that it should include when it's going to hurt a third party. Again, American law may see this issue very differently, but it does see this issue very differently, but in terms of what where the halachic understanding is of that, the Tzitz Eliezer takes this view that is the assumption. So certainly a Yirei Shamayim, a religious doctor, would not ever have in mind that it should include such a thing. Right, so that becomes a different question. So now that's an important question, but it's a different question. So one issue is, does this create a commitment which a person is morally not obligated to break? So that's what Tzitz Eliezer and others thought, that it does not, neither from the perspective of an individual promise or from the basic premises of the profession. But then the question is, so what about the effect that will have elsewhere? So there are a couple of ways in which it could have an effect. Before coming to the question of losing your license, even if the person is not going to lose his license, we'll come to that more in a second, but what if it's just going to have a situation where patients are not going to come forward to doctors anymore? What if it's going to get out that this doctor revealed what he knew, and future patients are not going to come to this doctor, are not going to go to any doctor, because they're going to be concerned that their information is not going to be kept confidential? So that's also a judgment call to what extent that plays a role. Zilberstein, he thought that was a far-off concern. Others didn't think it was such a far-off concern. Yaakov Ariel and his children, Shabbat Shal Torah, in a different context, maybe we'll get to, so he thought that is a legitimate consideration depending on how prominent and how pressing the risk is. If it's not a situation where a person really is directly threatening somebody else, maybe the risk that other patients aren't going to come, that's something to keep in mind and could legitimately be weighed. That's how he understood it. Hi.
Is that an
oath?
Is that the same thing as...
Right, so...
Does that count the same as they're verbally saying to me, don't reveal it?
Yeah, at most it counts the same.
You have to have...
Right. Right, so at most it... Right, so it could, and the Tzitz Eliezer actually talks about that also, and about whether it's different, he's doing it in writing and doing it verbally, but at most it counts as much as that. So, even if you assume that even if a person says it straight out, verbally, you know, is only binding under a certain understanding, if one accepts that type of deal, so then that would apply also to a written type of commitment. That's where at least the Tzitz Eliezer understood it. Hi. That is one of the trickier cases, because that case, again, I'm not coming from the perspective of a doctor, but it's a case where, in theory, the person could have a normal marital life. It doesn't necessarily have to impinge, but in theory, it's going to be something that the spouse is going to be aware of. It's going to be something which is going to have some type of an impact. So it is part of the more gray area, and I guess the best way to discuss it is to try to look at some of these case law cases that we'll talk about and see how it plays out. In general, we'll discuss some more principles about this also, but what is always advisable in these circumstances, it's always the best way, but especially if it's somewhat of a gray area, is that if a person can speak to the patient, if the doctor can speak to the patient and say, listen, I have a real moral conflict here, because I really think that you dating should be telling this to your spouse. I'm wrestling with the question of whether I'm obligated to tell them if you don't. The best idea, both what I think you should be doing and what's causing the situation for me, is for you to tell, and probably for a case like that, it would be appropriate for the person to tell. And that's probably the kind of thing also where a person who has gone out for a while and there's already enough of a relationship, a person can put that kind of thing in context. That's really the best solution to these to those type of situations. Now, sometimes it's not going to work. Sometimes the person will say, I'm sorry, I don't want to tell, and you're not allowed to tell, and you're stuck, and ha-ha, not like that, but you know that there's nothing you can do about it, so then you're really going to have more of an issue to wrestle with. But this is what I'm posting right throughout, that to whatever extent you can prevail upon the person himself to make that call, it's going to definitely be a better approach. So the shachan probably, in that case, you know, probably should say to the dater, should say, listen, when I set up Reuven in the Chana, should say to Reuven, listen, Reuven is a patient, should say, listen, I hope that you'll eventually things work out by the third or the fourth date, or tenth, depending on where you come from, or the 20th, or the first, whatever it is. I hope that by 80% of the way in, you're going to tell her that you have the circumstance, and that she'll accept you, the whole package. Then if you get the sense, and that sometimes what Shacham should do is really stay in touch for those reasons. If they feel like the person says, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to tell, then they get the thorny question of just how serious is the issue. And one point which some of the posts can point out, also in the context of some of these cases, which is not a perfect type of situation either, but Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein and others prefer a policy we call Megala Tefach Mechafet Tefachayim, that you reveal tefach while concealing two tefachim, that you say to the person, you know, there is some type of an issue, and then you see, okay, they say, well, tell me what kind of an issue. Or they say, well, I'm so in love, I don't care what kind of an issue it is. So then, you know, something like that, you know, then there is more ground to let them make their own decision. So that's also kind of a judgment call, and that's part of the complexity.